Canada is the world's leading mining nation.
60% of all public mining companies are listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange.
About half of all mining capital is raised in Canada.
Many Canadian mining companies have become notorious for damaging communities and the environment and fueling wars and repression all over the world.
They're displacing communities and killing people.
And they've left a legacy of mercury and lead contamination in that area that will never be cleaned up.
We use terms like genocide, ethnic cleansing.
We have a huge problem in terms of access to justice.
Just as European settlers created Canada by stealing and plundering native land, its mining companies today continue these practices all over the world.
This colonialism and neocolonialism is what Canada is all about.
You're listening to Path of Destruction, Canadian Mining Companies Around the World, a three-part radio documentary. I am Asad Ismi.
And I'm Kristen Schwartz. This is Who Benefits, the final episode in our series. For the next half hour, we focus on the enormous benefits that Canadian mining companies get from their operations and from government support. By devastating communities and the environment and fueling wars and repression around the world and at home, Canadian mining companies extract a considerable amount of wealth. This mainly benefits their executive officers and other shareholders. Ian Telfer, the chairman of Goldcorp, received $23 million in salary and stock benefits in 2006, making him the ninth highest paid executive in Canada. Meanwhile, Guatemala only gets a 1% royalty from Goldcorp's Marlin Mine. Edgar Godoy is a Guatemalan-Canadian labor leader.
They are offering 1% royalty, which will be divided, 0.5% for the central government, and further split half and half by the two communities where the mine operates. It's nonsense. Financially, economically, it doesn't make sense at all. You know, even if it was to say it would generate some money, it's not generating any significant money for those communities or for the government.
Jamie Neen is communications coordinator of Mining Watch Canada, the leading public interest advocate on mining issues.
The problem with the mining industry is that it concentrates wealth in the hands of the shareholders and the executives. It becomes sort of obvious when Ian Telfer, who is head of Goldcorp, made $23 million last year. He'll make less this year, but last year was a good year. And then turned around and set up his own fund at the University of Ottawa. So there's now the Telfer School of Management at the University of Ottawa. And yet you look at how much was going to the entire country of Guatemala, maybe a bit more than that, but for the whole country. And if you look at what they're paying the people who gave up their land to make way for the mine, it's maybe a few thousand dollars. And if you look at what they're paying their local employees, not their executives, a few thousand dollars here and there. They're called extractive industries because they extract a material, but they're actually extracting wealth.
In addition to executive officers, those benefiting most from mining revenues are pension funds, mutual funds, the banks, and the brokers. Mutual funds and pension funds account for the bulk of mining company shares. These funds are invested in by ordinary people who put their money aside in an RRSP or the Canada Pension Plan, and that money is being invested usually without their knowledge. However, the major benefit from these funds goes not to ordinary investors, but again to executive officers' salaries and bonuses.
Mutual funds see mining as a high-risk and high-return investment. One factor that makes mining high-risk is the sector's shadiness. Many Canadian junior mining companies are not really interested in developing a mine. They are mining investors. Investors in these companies are only interested in speculating, buying low and selling high. This encourages companies to hype their exploration activities outrageously. Due to such shadiness, the Vancouver Stock Exchange became known as the scam capital of the world. This was one of the reasons why its functions were folded into the Toronto Venture Exchange.
It's entirely possible for people to make a lot of money without a mine ever opening.
Absolutely, absolutely, and that's why they're mining the market. They're mining the financial market, not any actual resource. A lot of junior mining companies, most of them never open a mine. Most of them never even find a deposit that turns into a mine. But even the large companies, when they get involved in exploration, aren't necessarily more successful than anyone else. It's on the order of, in Canada in the last few years, it's on the order of one mine started out of maybe 1,000 exploration projects. And you can have entire exploration booms. And again, this is fueled by the tax benefits and the investment hype. Well, the result is that the stock goes up and then collapses. And anyone who had share options and exercised them at the right time and sold the stock when it was doing well made a lot of money. And everyone else was left sucking wind, you know. And that's what happens, and that's why it's a high risk game for investors.
The biggest mining fraud in history was perpetrated by Calgary-based Briex Gold Minerals in 1997, when the company falsified gold samples and claimed that its mine in Indonesia contained 200 million ounces of gold. The price of Briex shares shot up to $200 each. When it was discovered that the mine was a hoax, investors lost an astounding $6 billion. The scandal led to more regulation by the stock exchange of mining activities and the introduction of rules for reporting potential mineral deposits. In July 2007, a seven-year-long lawsuit brought by investors against John Felderhoff, the company's founder and chief geologist, concluded. Shockingly, the judge found that the executive was not guilty of misleading investors. Given such a verdict, fraud by Canadian mining companies continues, as in the case of Southwestern Resources Corporation.
You know, they said they had a sizable thing, and it turned out there was nothing there at all. This is just a few months ago. So it can still happen. Maybe it just gets caught earlier because of the slightly improved regulation. But overall, Canada has a long history of separating little old ladies from their money in the mining sector.
One of the pension funds investing in mining companies is the Ontario Municipal Employees Retirement System, or OMERS, which is run by the Ontario government. The pension money in OMERS includes that from the Canadian Union of Public Employees, CUPE, and other public sector unions. The decision to invest in mining companies is made by OMERS, not by CUPE. Edgar Godoy is president of CUPE Local 2191.
From the Ontario Municipal Employees Retirement Fund, or OMERS, there is almost $400 million that Goldcorp has its hands on them. So we have to show and demonstrate to the members that their monies are being used to displace communities in Guatemala, indigenous community, Mayan communities. They're displacing communities in Mexico, displacing indigenous communities in Colombia, and killing people, basically. So members have to become aware that it's not worth it to allow these corporations to invest the pension funds money in such schemes. The other element, which is crucial here, as I said, is unions have to take control of the pension funds.
Godoy wants CUPE to divest its pension money from mining companies and is working to accomplish that.
The Canadian government claims that mining provides 388,000 jobs in Canada. But the actual figure is less than 24,000 employed in metal mining and 25,000 in smelting. The government includes all sectors of the mineral industry, from mining to manufacturing, in its statistics. According to Mining Watch, many of these jobs would still be there and might in fact increase if mining raw materials were to be progressively replaced by recycling of existing minerals. Many of the 49,000 mining jobs in Canada are high paying, but mining is also hazardous work, and these high wages are not shared by miners in southern countries who make up the majority of mine workers.
By itself, mining is not economically viable. The mining sector is based on massive government subsidies, and mining companies pay little in taxes. Mining Watch Canada did a study of subsidies in 2001. Joan Kuyek is national coordinator of Mining Watch.
The total subsidies that we could count to the mining industry across the country were $600 million a year. And what we knew from 1998 studies that Jack Mintz had done was that the mining industry had only paid less than $200 million in taxes into federal and provincial governments per year at that time. But they were paying less in taxes than they were getting in subsidies by almost a factor of three. Taking the subsidies away, just taking them away, would be a huge blow to this economy, because it's systemically built around it.
There are subsidies at the federal and provincial level.
The federal government has a number of subsidies. They contribute directly to infrastructure. They help build ports, they help build railroads, they contribute to major highways. The federal government puts billions into the cleanup of abandoned mine sites and doesn't do a very good job of trying to hold companies accountable for the mess they made in the first place. They have a tax system that has very low corporate taxes, that's phased out the capital tax. In Canada, mining exploration is subsidized by the Accelerated Capital Cost Allowance, which allows them to deduct 100% of expenses in 1 year. And it also, by the Super Flow Through Share program, which allows them to flow their expenses through to investors from exploration, and gives the investors a 15% tax credit in addition to that.
The Flow Through Share program allows investors in exploration to get their money back as a tax write-off. In this way, the Canadian government actually pays for a lot of mining exploration. Not only do mining companies pay low taxes, some don't pay any at all for decades.
One of the things that mining companies have done has been part of the very strong lobby to cut back on capital tax, to make sure that income tax, corporate taxes are reduced, to make sure that there's all sorts of loopholes and so on in mining tax. Companies like Chemist South, mines like Chemist South, didn't pay taxes till their last year of operation. I heard the other day that Hudson's Bay Mining and Smelting in Manitoba paid taxes last year for the first time, their mining tax last year, for the first time in 75 years of operation. And they've left a legacy of mercury and lead contamination in that area that will never be cleaned up.
The Canadian government also subsidizes and provides critical political support for the foreign operations of Canadian mining companies. Karen Keenan is program officer of the Halifax Initiative Coalition, which monitors Canada's international economic role.
There's a number of ways involving different government departments. In some cases, they're providing financial support to companies, and in some cases, it's more political backing. So for financing, we have examples like Export Development Canada. There's also a fund within the Canadian International Development Agency called Canadian Investment Fund for Africa, promoting private sector investment in the mining sector. So it provides subsidies to Canadian mining companies to encourage them to invest in Africa. Export Development Canada also provides insurance, which is another form of political backing, because it insures private sector investments. And of course, another form of financial support is through the Canadian pension plan. The Canadian, it's heavily invested in mining companies and some of the worst ones.
The political support that the Canadian government provides to mining companies investing abroad has included actually changing the mining code of a country to favor the companies at the expense of the local people, as in the case of Colombia.
Our embassies are very active in promoting, some of them are active in promoting Canadian investments and have come out publicly to support projects that have been contested locally. We also promote Canadian investments on trade junkets. So prime ministers or ministers will accompany companies to foreign countries and help facilitate meetings with important decision makers in order to enhance their possibilities of acquiring concessions and so on. So those kinds of political connections can be very advantageous to Canadian companies, as we've seen in the past.
Such enormous official subsidies and significant political backing for mining reflect the formidable power the sector has over the government. This is further enhanced when former Canadian prime ministers serve as directors of and advisors to mining companies. These include Brian Mulroney on the board of Barrick Gold, Jean Chrétien on the board of Viceroy Resource, and Joe Clark as special advisor on Africa to First Quantum Minerals. Such national leaders make powerful promoters for the mining companies at home and abroad. Peter Monk, the chairman of Barrick Gold, explained Mulroney's appointment to the board by saying, "Mulroney knows every dictator in the world on a first-name basis."
Taken. Some are treated well in these games of buy and sell, and some, like poor beasts, are burdened down to breaking.
Canadian mining companies benefit greatly from the Canadian government's massive financial and political support, but this is not enough to provide them access to the resources of southern countries. Crucial in this regard is the United States government's imperialist attack on the South, which has killed 38 million people since 1945. Such massive genocide has made it possible for Canadian mining to go into many countries, especially the Congo, Guatemala, and Chile.
The Congo was invaded by U.S. proxies Rwanda and Uganda in 1998, partly to fulfill the American aim of opening up the country to Western mining companies. The invasion has resulted in the deaths of more than 5 million Congolese. Once the U.S. had encouraged and facilitated the invasion, Canadian mining companies could then enter the Congo and plunder its rich minerals.
In Guatemala, the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency orchestrated a military coup that overthrew the elected left-wing government of Jacobo Arbenz in 1954. His removal led to 4 decades of military dictatorship and civil war, which killed 250,000 Guatemalans. The CIA coup opened Guatemala to Western multinationals, and Canadian companies came to dominate the mining sector. A CIA-engineered coup in Chile in 1973 had the same result. The coup, led by General Augusto Pinochet, killed the country's elected left-wing leader Salvador Allende and led to the deaths of 120,000 Chileans. Barrick Gold then became prominent in Chile's mining sector.
At a shareholders' meeting in 1996, Peter Monk, chairman of Barrick Gold, praised the vicious military dictator Pinochet for, quote, "transforming Chile from a wealth-destroying socialist state to a capital-friendly model that is being copied around the world," end quote. Richard Helms was director of the CIA when the agency used Pinochet to overthrow Allende. Writer David Baruski states in a detailed article on Barrick that Helms has been one of the mining company's directors. Barrick's close link to the U.S. government is best displayed by the fact that Monk appointed former U.S. President and CIA Director George Bush Sr. to its board. Monk even got Bush an honorary degree from the University of Toronto.
Canadian mining companies fit well into the U.S. strategy of denying southern countries use of their own natural resources, especially for industrialization. The U.S. government and the Canadian companies act in collaboration to ensure that these resources only develop northern economies. Progressive southern leaders such as Allende and Arbenz, who wanted to use their national resources for the benefit of their own people, have been eliminated by Washington.
Given such strong official Canadian support, as well as U.S. imperialist backing for Canadian mining companies, it is no surprise that attempts to regulate them and hold them accountable for their disastrous practices have led nowhere so far. In July 2005, after studying the issue in depth, the Canadian House of Commons Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs and International Trade asked the government to take action to end the devastating social and environmental impacts of Canadian mining operations abroad. A standing committee report called on the government to stop using taxpayer money to support destructive Canadian mining projects abroad and hold Canadian mining companies legally accountable for environmental and human rights violations in other countries.
The Liberal government under Paul Martin rejected the committee's recommendations and insisted that the issue should be studied even more. The government then started holding a series of public forums called the National Roundtables on Corporate Social Responsibility and the Canadian Extractive Industry in Developing Countries. This roundtable process resulted in a number of recommendations, which after a year and a half, the Conservative government under Stephen Harper still has not even responded to. Karen Keenan with the Halifax Initiative Coalition participated in the roundtable process.
It was a very constructive discussion, very high-level discussion, and a lot of ideas were generated. And then the advisory group, against all odds, managed to bring all this information together and come up with a set of consensus-based recommendations. And we saw that as a huge victory and an enormous accomplishment. And so it is disappointing to then be stuck in this holding pattern for a year.
Given the government's failure to act, criticism of Canada from around the world has mounted, led by Indigenous and environmental groups, religious and human rights organizations, and even the United Nations. By refusing to regulate Canadian mining companies and hold them accountable, the government has turned Canada into a haven for corporations that damage communities and the environment and fuel wars and repression all over the world. Canadian corporate environmental and human rights violations go unpunished in Canada, turning the country into a promoter of corporate crimes. Corporate impunity is also encouraged by the Canadian judicial system, which refuses to try the companies for their destructive practices abroad.
When 23,000 affected citizens of Guyana sued the Canadian companies Cambior and Golden Star in a Canadian court for destroying the main river in their country in 1995, the judge sent the case back to Guyana, saying the company could not be prosecuted in Canada.
The classic example is the Omai mine in Guyana. It's almost impossible for non-nationals, non-Canadians, who are affected by Canadian companies to access our judicial system when they are wronged by Canadian companies. So we have a huge problem in terms of access to justice. There are all kinds of cases of widespread and serious environmental contamination that has not been addressed, it has not been mitigated, and no compensation has been paid either to the governments where these mines have happened or to the peoples who have suffered from that contamination. Absolutely.
In contrast, in the United States, any U.S. company can be sued by foreign nationals for violating their human rights under the Alien Tort Claims Act. This makes Canada even more of a corporate-dominated state than the U.S. is.
The thousands of people all over the world whose livelihoods have been destroyed by Canadian mining companies cannot sue them in Canadian courts. But if Canadians merely point out such practices, they can be sued by the corporations in the same courts for millions of dollars. This brings Canada close to being a corporate dictatorship. Recently, three French-Canadian authors published the book Noir Canada, Plunder, Corruption, and Criminality in Africa. The authors and their Quebec publisher are being sued by Barrick Gold and Banro Corporation for $11 million simply for publishing information that is critical of these companies' activities in the Congo and Tanzania. This is a warning to anyone writing about these companies that they will not tolerate criticism. William Satcher is one of the authors of Noir Canada.
I think this is really dangerous. This is really dangerous for any journalist, any person who wants to bring political debate at the level of the public sphere, it means that you can be attacked by such a structure, a powerful structure, who is able to pervert the judicial system just to bring you down. And that's really scary. They just send us the lawsuit, and they put us in trouble for months, even years. That's all this lawsuit is about, and that's why we call it a SLAP, a strategic lawsuit against public participation, which is just intimidation of groups of citizens which want to bring to the public sphere political debates. Yeah, they just want to prevent us from speaking. That's dangerous because also, you know, in the medias, you will never find, you will barely find critical views about Canadian companies' activities abroad. And when we do know, we do think that the Canadian citizens have the right to get this information. So that's why it's so important.
No matter how much they suppress criticism, Canadian mining companies cannot hide the fact that they are implicated in crimes against humanity, war crimes, and environmental devastation all over the world. These companies are another instrument by which Europe and North America have been plundering the resources of the South and North for more than 500 years. This imperialism has resulted in the Holocaust of more than 600 million people in the South, and close to 15 million in the North. Through such massive killing, northern countries that make up only 20% of the world's population have gained control of 80% of its resources and wealth. This murderous disparity can only be changed by popular resistance in the South and North, including resistance to the operations of Canadian mining companies.
In Canada, Native groups are leading this resistance. Similarly, people are opposing the incursions of Canadian mining companies all over the global south, including in Papua New Guinea, Guatemala, Venezuela, Chile, Argentina, Mexico, Ecuador, Peru, Kenya, the Congo, and Tanzania. The government of Ecuador has suspended all mining in the country. Venezuela has stopped all open pit and gold mining. Bolivia has nationalized its minerals. In particular, Venezuela has taken the lead in gaining control of its national resources and creating an alternative economy to what its president, Hugo Chavez, calls savage capitalism. Latin America today has 11 left-wing governments that are following Venezuela's progressive lead. Edgar Godoy.
At the end of the day, it's about workers taking control of the resources, including the natural resources, including the economy of the country. It's about workers' control. This is the bottom line.
In the North and South.
In the North and South. And we can do it through solidarity between country to country, community to community, worker to worker, organization to organization.
You have been listening to Who Benefits?, the final episode of the documentary series Path of Destruction, Canadian Mining Companies Around the World.
Path of Destruction, Canadian Mining Companies Around the World is dedicated to Indigenous peoples everywhere.
This documentary was written by Asad Ismi and produced by Kristen Schwartz. Go to www.asadismi.ws. That's www.asadismi.ws. to download the series.
Translation by Alex Petrov, Susie Alvarez, William Satcher, and Sandra Cuff. Voiceover by Matthew Fava and Susie Alvarez.
Theme music is Shaman's Call and Come Home Safe Dance Mix by TKO from Winnipeg, Canada. On this episode, you also heard Dog Eat Dog by Canada's Jonene Mitchell.
Many thanks to Danae Peart and Kevin Shaw of CHRY 105.5 FM in Toronto.
This documentary was funded by the Canadian Union of Postal Workers National,
CUPW Local 576 North Bay,
Canadian Union of Public Employees Local 3903,
QP National,
Ontario Public Service Employees Union,
Ontario Secondary School Teachers Federation,
Ontario English Catholic Teachers Association,
Public Service Alliance of Canada,
Ken Lukart,
and the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives.
Thank you for listening.